day. And I heard behind me a loud voice, like the sound of a trumpet, saying, write in a book what you see and send it to the seven churches, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamum, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea. So this is what sets the scene for the next two whole chapters of Revelation, the seven churches. We're going to be looking at the first church. You'll notice right at the beginning of chapter one is Ephesus. So we're going to be starting right into there. And we're going to have some pictures up on the screen to help you see a little bit about the history. You've got your sermon notes inside your worship guide right here that you can follow along with if you wish. And I would like to tell you, starting off, the story of the history of Ephesus. So let's dive in. We start off at about 550 BC, and the sun beats hot on the brow of a commander named Croesus of Lydia. He's got all of his warriors behind him, and he's looking out at this city called Ephesus. All these little stone structures are scattered around the Pion Hill. Their windows are open, looking out over the Aegean Sea, sparkling in the sun. There's a little bay right there. It's a fairly small city, but it's a city nonetheless. It's a great site. There's a little temple dedicated to their goddess, Artemis, that's been there for a very, very long time. And he thinks, wow, this is a great site. It will be no problem to conquer. He and his army sweep in and destroy the entire city. And what happens is the Ephesus that Croesus leaves behind is an entirely new Ephesus, no longer on a hill, but down in the valley to the northeast, surrounding the Artemis Temple. Well, 200 years go by, and a new commander, one much bigger than this guy, named Alexander the Great, you may have heard of him, he has an army that sweeps through the entire known world. And in his vast campaign's wake, he leaves behind the Greek culture. This is called Hellenism. He leaves versions of Greek culture all throughout the world, and that culture influences every city that he has passed through and left behind. It's in that time that a man named Lysimachus fortifies a new harbor in Ephesus. They had always looked down on this little Aegean Sea harbor here, and he puts things around it in emplacements, and you'll see on this picture here, up to the upper left of the corner, there's an ancient little harbor that comes in right next to the city. This changes Ephesus totally. Instead of being centered around the temple where Artemis is and around that whole cult following, suddenly there's a new center for commerce. There's a whole new trade system. There's a huge marketplace set up right next to the harbor. So where does everyone go? Where the money and the prosperity and the livelihood is. The whole city moves once more to the harbor. And so the Artemis Temple is still a mile or so away, but the whole city, the city of change, Ephesus, is planted again in a different place around the harbor. Well, the temple, even though it's just a mile away still, is still a really prominent part of the city. But around this time of Alexander the Great, it's actually burned to the ground. This guy who wants to immortalize his name or whatever comes up and sets the whole thing to fire. And the whole thing burns down in a blaze of glory. And the Ephesians are just devastated. They think, oh, we've got the harbor, but what has happened to our temple? So they quickly rebuild it. And this structure that they rebuild is going to be an amazing structure. This was four times the size of the Parthenon in Athens. It was 420 feet long, 220 feet wide, and 60 feet high. Have you guys ever been to the Long Beach Edwards Cinema Multiplex Center in the Long Beach Town Center? That is how big it was. The whole movie Cineplex, that's the size of this temple right here. It was huge. If you can imagine building a building that big, like centuries before Christ, that was quite an undertaking. It had 127 columns rising up, made of solid marble, gold overlaying many of them, jewels all over them. And these things would tower above each of the priests and priestesses walking amongst the holy sacred grounds there. This was a seat for all of Ephesian wealth
too. There was so much wealth, so much power in this temple that it really became somewhat of a bank and somewhat of the financial center of the city as well. So this temple was not only glorious and not only this beacon and well-known thing, it had power behind it. All this around the Artemis cult. And Artemis herself stood inside. The dark statue of Artemis herself. We see a picture here that's overlaid in gold, and Artemis has got a basket on her head. She's got necklaces around her neck. She's got animals and symbols of fertility and life all over her. Ways that she was a nature goddess before, and now she's a fertility goddess that brings life and abundance, but brings produce to the people who worship her. We see a couple different things on her that are even mentioned on city coins from Ephesus from this period too. And we see that there's a symbolic tree that's often behind her. It's kind of hard to see, but these are coins from about that Greek era. And she's standing there with her classic bow and arrow, and she's got her tree behind her too. This was signified that she had a date palm tree that was often behind her that she had used to be associated with her worship. So Artemis was no small countryside Anatolian nature goddess anymore. She was no longer just worshipped as like this little idol structure underneath the tree. Now she was in this huge temple. Now she had this huge cult following. Now she was the financial center of the biggest city of Asia. Now people would come from weeks, for months, to come to Ephesus to pay her homage so they could have good crops, so they could have prosperity, so that their lands would be fertile. She was doing really well for herself, this idol. So she was the center of the Asian world, i.e. West Turkey, at this time. In fact, the Artemis Temple was so powerful that it even rivaled the prominence of the harbor in the city. So these two main things in the city were the main focal points and were almost kind of like rivals with each other. So the next thing that happens is the Roman Empire comes in and takes Ephesus and makes it their own city in their vast Roman Empire. Now, Ephesus was powerful and strong enough that they still had some autonomy. They were still able to have some of their local leaders still do a lot of the same things. But the Romans did own the city. So what happened was a lot of different Roman emperors had temples built to them in the city too. So not only was there the cult following of Artemis that was so powerful in this city, but there were some other little temples and other things too dedicated to all these emperors. There was one dedicated to Claudius and one to Hadrian and also the Emperor Severus. And they had all sorts of little monuments and fountains and temples all over the place in Ephesus. Here's an example of the Hadrian Temple right here, what has survived of it so far. But none of these monuments even held a candle to the Temple of Artemis. It was so big, so powerful. The emperor worship was kind of like a second thought that the Romans tried to squeeze in. The Romans actually referred to Artemis in Latin and called her Diana. So if you've ever heard of that, this Roman coin says Diana Ephesia. So this is from a Roman time. And again, we see that Artemis is there with her basket on her head, all of her glittering stuff. She's got two stags on each side and somewhat of a tree leaf thing behind her as well. So if, again, all a Roman citizen would have to do, or anyone who lived in Ephesus, such to pull out a coin, and they would see, oh yeah, there's the goddess that our city it worships, and it pretty much identifies our city to the world. It'd be really easy to remember. One thing happened in the Roman period too. There was an idea from Persia of an idea of a paradise garden. This was an idea that you would have a kingly garden. Only kings actually had money for this kind of thing. But they'd throw up a garden and make walls around it so it was super safe. No one could get in, no one could get out. And they'd fill with all sorts of lush trees and bushes and plants. There'd be fruit trees so you could pick things from it and eat it. They'd actually stock these gardens with game. So there'd be like deer running around. And like these rich kings could go into these safe, protected, fertile, lush gardens and chase around game and hunt. And just, it was so fertile and it was so awesome. These kings would have these gardens. There was a garden like that put around the Artemision, the temple of Artemis. And so again, it was expanding into the city and had more of an influence. And this paradise garden was made. And it was actually believed that these lush, safe places usually were places where deities would dwell. So it only made sense for this huge goddess of Artemis to have a garden of her own. So that was put into place here too. One last thing is that Ephesus, at the time of the Roman Empire, when they started to take control of them, it was the cosmopolitan hub of West Turkey. There were three main trade routes. One came from Colossae, one came from Galatia, and one came from south from the Meander Valley. And all these converged on Ephesus. And Ephesus was also the principal seaport of that side of Turkey too. So if you can imagine like the LA area or San Francisco, or like maybe Portland, but or Seattle, Washington, like all the, on the edges of the western side of the United States. These are the main ports. If any shipping or any goods are going to be traveled to the inland cities, they have to go to these coastal cities first. Ephesus was the primary coastal city. So you can imagine just all the traffic, all the people going through here. This was such a cosmopolitan, big, large, and diverse city of people. So knowing that, in 52 AD, a ship comes into the harbor. And who steps off but the Apostle Paul himself? He's got Priscilla and Aquila with him, his missionary friends, and they start walking from the harbor down the Arcadian Way. There's pillars lining up each side. It's magnificent. They look off to their right, and they see a busy marketplace, the Agora, that was near the port. They look off to their left, they see a huge gymnasium. They see a giant athletic field. And they look straight ahead, and they see this massive, great theater all stretched out across the hillside. This theater could hold 25,000 spectators. That's a lot. Think about this age. This is just after Christ. This is the first century. It can hold that many people. This was a big city. Paul chose this strategically. So we're going to go into all the history of Paul in our growth groups this week, so I'm not going to touch too much on that, but I'll just say he was there for about 3 years and three different trips and had a huge influence in the city of Ephesus and for the church of Ephesus too. But I'd like to jump, for purposes of time, I'd like to jump ahead to another key personality in the church of Ephesus, the Apostle John. It's widely believed that John, who wrote Revelation, actually lived in Ephesus and was an elder in the church there. He lived there for quite some time and had a huge influence in Ephesus. So it's no surprise that he should be writing this letter, and the Ephesians are going to get it and know who he is. But one day, soldiers arrive at John's door. There had always been persecution in Ephesus. You can imagine how powerful the Artemis cult is and how powerful the persecution might be. But the Ephesian Christians didn't see this one coming just yet. Suddenly, John has disappeared. And rumors trickle down that he's been exiled on an island called Patmos, 60 miles away from the city, off in the Aegean Sea where no one can reach him. Most of his Christian brothers and sisters never think that they'll see him ever again. But one day, a messenger comes to another elder in the church. He had just come in off of the harbor, and he tells him, "Hey, I've got news," and hands him a letter from the Apostle John himself. News at last! The church quickly gets together. Everyone tries to get together and make a big assembly, and an elder grabs that letter, and he unfurls it and says, "We've got news." Everyone gather around, and they're so excited. This elder from the church starts to read seven messages to seven churches and starts reading aloud the book of Revelation as we know it today for the first time. And you can just imagine, the Ephesian Christians are so eager. They're like, "We haven't heard from John so far and so long. We're so excited." So they gather around to listen to what their exiled elder had to say to them and what his news was. And what they read that ended up applying directly to their church was what we now know as chapter 2. So I'd like you to turn
or look to chapter 2 in your Bibles. And we're going to see what those Ephesian Christians were hearing as one of their leaders read aloud John's letter to them. Chapter 2, verse 1, says, "To the angel of the church in Ephesus write, the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand, the one who walks among the seven golden lampstands, says this." Well, if you were here last week or you remember chapter 1, you might remember what those stars are, or what those lampstands are, right? Even if you don't, all you have to do is look back in the previous verse. Chapter 1, verse 20. "As for the mystery of the seven stars you saw in my right hand, the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. The seven lampstands are the seven churches." Okay, so there we go. We're breaking down what verse 1 is saying. The one who holds the seven stars, that is Jesus. And this is not the Jesus meek and mild that we sometimes hear about in Sunday school. This is not the weak, white, Anglo-Saxon, pathetic surfer Jesus that we sometimes see in ancient movies that's like, "Oh, bless you." You know, like, this is not that Jesus. And just to prove my point, I want us to look again at chapter 1, verse 16 through 18. Let's see who's writing this letter. Verse 16 says, "In his right hand he held seven stars, and out of his mouth came a sharp, two-edged sword. His face was like the sun, shining in all its strength. When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. He placed his right hand on me, saying, 'Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last, and the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades.'" This is who the author of the letter to the Ephesians is. This is who's writing the letters to the seven churches. The Christ who has authority, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. This is the Christ we see that comes in Revelation 19 and puts an end to evil for all time. This is who's authoring this letter. So as we read, let's keep in mind that this Jesus, who John falls in front of like a dead man because of his majesty and his authority, that's who's writing this letter. Whew. I think the Ephesians would want to sit up straight and listen pretty closely. Also, we see that Jesus not only has power and authority, but he has knowledge. It says that he walks amongst the lampstands. We all know the lampstands of the church, right? So the lampstands, as we mentioned a little bit with Chris last week, if we think about lampstands, we can think about the Old Testament. And Jesus walking amongst the lampstands is almost like reminiscent of an Old Testament priest in the Jerusalem temple walking amongst the lampstand there. There's a lampstand always in the temple, and it had seven on it, and we often refer to it as a menorah. Seven lampstands, priestly person, caretaking for them. Jesus is making an allusion saying, the lampstands of the churches, I am the caretaker. I am the custodian of the churches. I am the one overseeing them, watching them, observing them, caring for them. That's who Jesus is. Not only does he have the authority as Son of God, but he knows intimately what his churches are about. He knows who they are, and he knows what they're going through. He understands the persecution that they are under. He gets where they're coming from. This is who the author of this book is. We'll talk more about Jesus through Revelation, I'm sure, but it's just so cool to see who Jesus is as he does this. Well, he's got some great glowing things to mention to the Ephesians. So let's move on into verse 2. Jesus says a few things. He says in verse 2, "I know your deeds, your toil, and your perseverance, that you cannot tolerate evil men. You put to the test those who call themselves apostles, and they are not, and you found them to be false. And you have perseverance and have endured for my name's sake and have not grown weary." Wow. This is really cool. The Ephesian Christians, hearing this letter being read to them as their elder reads out this new message, would be like, "Yeah, we got it. We got this. Oh, man, we're doing good. This is cool." And Jesus is saying somewhat of a similar thing. He's like, "You guys are doing good. Look at this cool stuff you got going on." There's three main things he's talking about. They've got good deeds in the first part of verse 2. They've got great doctrine, and they've got a good history. Let's look at the good deeds they've got. Verse 2, "I know your deeds and your toil and your perseverance." If we went to the Ephesus church today and you opened up the Ephesus worship guide, maybe it would be like a scroll or something, it would be stuffed full of activity. The Ephesus church calendar would have been packed to the seams with different ministries going on. It's not like they all met in one giant building like we would at church these days, but the Ephesus facilities manager would be here every day, every night, setting up and tearing down and putting up chairs and tearing and doing all this stuff because there'd be so much stuff going on there. Ephesus had so many great things going on. They had the deeds thing down. They were doing so much in their community. They were loving each other so much. They were doing a lot of stuff. They also believed a lot of the right doctrine too. Second half of verse 2. You cannot tolerate evil men. You put to the test those who call themselves apostles, and they are not. And you found them to be false. Well, this is pretty encouraging, too, for the Ephesians to hear, too, because there was a lot of people with false doctrine and saying false things about God. Now, oftentimes in this era of Christianity, these people don't even have the whole Bible put together. They don't have all the epistles all in one binding yet. They haven't even met a lot of the people who are leading and starting the church yet. Ephesus had met more than others, but still there'd be people traveling from town to town and they'd come into town and be like, hey, I'm an apostle, so listen to what I have to say. They wouldn't necessarily claim to be one of the 12 because they'd be found out pretty quickly that they weren't, but like Paul or Barnabas, they'd say they were someone like that. Be like, I am an apostle and here's what I have to say. And oftentimes, they were just in it for the money. They'd fleece the crowd and leave town richer than they came, and everyone else sad and dejected or believing something heretical. Now, there were two kinds of heresies that were really popular in this day. One was antinomianism, and that is anti, not or against. The nom root means law, and so it's against the law. So antinomianism almost ended up being kind of like a hedonistic libertinism. Do whatever you want. We're free from the law, right? Christ set us free from the law. We don't have to be part of that. You don't have to follow anything. You just live how you want to live, and God's grace will cover you, whatever you want. And so people would come into the churches and say these kind of things. They'd also come in and say things that were syncretistic, which means you'd be syncing or putting together idolatry with Christianity and kind of mixing them together. If you worship Artemis at the temple, that's not really that big of a deal. What's the big deal about throwing a little bit of spice or some kind of like offering to the Roman emperors? That's fine. That's your civic duty. As a good citizen, you should do that. And you can still worship Jesus on Sundays too. That's okay. All these religions all have truth inside them, right? There's at the base, they're all kind of the same, right? All religions are just all spokes on a wheel leading to the same hub. We all believe the same God when it comes down to it at the end of the day, right? Right? And the Ephesians would say, no, that is not what we believe, and that's not true. And the Ephesians would test these leaders. They would see if their prophecies came true. They would check the Bible and see if they were true. And if they weren't, they would kick them out and say, that does not belong in our church, and we do not want our people believing something that is false about God. And so the Ephesian Christians were doing really good with this too. Really good. One other thing, if we think about Ephesus in our time, an Ephesian growth group or an Ephesian equipping hour class, if you went to it, man, they would care so much about the Bible. They'd be really doctrinally accurate. They would make sure that whatever was being taught or whatever you heard in that growth group or equipping hour class, man, it was bona fide truth from God's word. There's one more thing that Jesus says. I'm proud of you guys for this. Jesus says that they have a good history. Part of that is that they've got a really great pedigree. Who was at their church from the beginning? Paul, the Apostle Paul himself, Priscilla and Aquila. Timothy was a pastor of the Ephesus church. Apollos was there at the beginning. The Apostle John himself was at the Ephesus church. These guys had a stellar lineup, such a great leadership history. And it says in verse 3, if we check back there again, you have perseverance and have endured for not my name's sake. They have persevered and endured. They've got a great track record with their relationship with God, with their following of God. So they've got a good history too. Think about Ephesus in our time. If we were a church of Ephesus or similar to it, the families in Ephesus would be longtime serving, faithful families. The Ephesus families would send out many strong missionaries like Apollo to Corinth. They would stay faithful despite the cultural pressures from the Artemis cult and from the emperors. This is great. Jesus is going through all these things. He's commending them on so many levels. He's like, wow, your deeds are great. Wow, your doctrine is sure and solid. You've got this great lineup of history. You're faithful. You persevered. And the Ephesian Christians are like, yeah, this is great. This is so cool. Like, our church is great. It's powerful. It's doing great things. And then the Ephesian elder would get to this word. But, oh, and the Ephesian Christians listening to this letter would, and get the feeling like, ooh, the shoe is about to drop. Verse 4, Jesus, through John, through this letter, says, but I have this against you. You have left your first love. Not forgotten or misplaced, left. And what the Greek means here, first love, is that you have left the love that you had at first. The love that you had when you were first so fired up for God. That energy that you had when you first started loving and pursuing God. Versus a cold, dead orthodoxy that has relapsed into tradition. Jesus talks about this right after he has all this commendation. There's a sense of condemnation. And Jesus says, your good deeds are great, but they don't matter if you don't love Jesus. Remember 1 Corinthians 13, 1 and 2, where Paul says, I can do all these great things, but if I have not love, it does not matter. The Ephesians had great doctrine. They believed the right things. But remember the Middle Ages when the church would persecute or rather hunt down heretics and burn them and eradicate heresy from the church? Well, it's good to keep a doctrinally pure church, but oftentimes that church was still cold and dead and loveless. Now, it's okay also to have a good history like the Ephesians did too. It's okay to be persevering and be tireless, but to be tireless and persevere in order to preserve a church that's cold and unloving, Jesus also says, that's worthless. Love, loving Jesus, is what's important. He goes on to say that sometimes when we think about this, sometimes we do too much. And the things we do get in the way of our loving. So Jesus would say to Ephesus, don't think about what new ministry you have to join, Ephesian Christian. Don't think about what new deed you have to do. Focus on what you need to do to invest in your loving relationship with Jesus. Then those things will follow. Now, the Ephesian Christians had some things to fear because Jesus actually has some consequences that are going to come with this too. If we look in verse 5, the second part of it, I'm going to jump down to that. He says, or else I am coming to you and will remove your lampstand out of its place. Remembering that lampstand means church, Jesus is going to remove the church. Remember, he is the Son of God and he is the custodian of the lampstands. He has the authority to do this. He has the know-how how to do this. He can do this. And he has the right to. Jesus has authority to remove the biggest, most influential, most powerful, most famous church of that entire region out of the city that it's dwelling in. But even the largest lampstand should be removed if the flame on top of it is not being allowed to burn brightly, right? So this would strike fear into Ephesians in a really special way. The Ephesus harbor was just on the edge of the city. And if you remember, Ephesians had moved a number of times in the history of their city, right? They were first on the Pion Hill, and then they moved down to the temple, and then they moved over to the harbor after it was reinforced and everything. So the fear for the Ephesians would be, is that they knew there was a river called the Cayster River flowing into that harbor. And every couple of years, they would notice that that Cayster River kept pouring silt and debris into their harbor. Slowly and slowly, the water line would recede every year. And they'd have to move the harbor a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more. Can you imagine if the Long Beach port completely filled up with debris and there was no more water in it? What would that do to our city? What would that do to our economy? What would that do to our society here in Long Beach? I have heard that 1 in 10 jobs in all of Long Beach is focused and working at the port. That would have a huge impact in us. It was the same thing for Ephesus. If their harbor completely filled up, their city would be devastated, and the only thing left in their city that would be the main point of prominence would be the Artemis Temple. And the city would once again be plucked up and moved to that central beacon over there. If you can imagine the Christian thinking, if our harbor fills up and we have to move back to the Artemis Temple, there is going to be a world of persecution increasing if we have to live right underneath that temple and right next to it. So this would scare. This may be what Jesus is kind of referring to. This is some cultural context here, but you can imagine just how scary this would be. And you can imagine just how hard it would be for the Ephesians to hear this. Think about if Elbach sent out a missionary a while ago, and he goes off for a whole lifetime of service. And then he comes back here to 3331 Palo Verde Avenue, Long Beach, California. And what does he find here? What if he finds just a parking lot? That would be so sad, would it not? So you can feel what the Ephesian Christians would feel like. Our lampstand is going to be removed? So they're listening very closely as Jesus says the rest of this letter. Let's look at the first part of Ephesians 5. Jesus offers hope. He says in verse 5, therefore, remember from where you have fallen and repent and do the deeds you did at first. Okay, we've got three commands here. Remember, repent, and return to deeds. This is really interesting. Remember, like Israel had to be reminded over and over, like Ephesus needs to be reminded over and over. Do you see how we always need to be reminded over and over again what God does in our lives and what God has done faithfully in our lives before? Jesus is saying, remember when you were so fired up for God. Remember when you forgave, when you reached out, when you loved others because you loved Jesus so much. Remember when you told all your friends at school about Jesus because you were just so excited about him. Remember how you told all your coworkers, hey, I've met Jesus, and I know it's weird for me to bring this up, but I'm just so excited about him. He's changed my life, and he's done so many things for me, and I'm just amazed. I just have to tell you, I can't stay silent because I love Jesus so much. Remember when you used to come to church for maybe the first time, or maybe when you used to come back to church after a long time being away. Remember how it used to feel when you would come in and you were excited to worship God. Remember when you would raise your hands. Remember when you would kneel. Remember when there were tears in your eyes because you loved Jesus so much. Jesus is saying, love me first. Love me first. He asks the Ephesians to repent. Also, and repentance is an active step towards redirecting your life, leaving the old and striving towards the new. He also says return to good deeds. And this is kind of when we get into verse 6. Verse 6 talks about, it says, yet this you have, that you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Seems kind of odd for Jesus to throw that in there. Why didn't he throw that in there with the commendation that he did in verse 2 and 3? I think he puts this in here because he wants to remind the Ephesian Christians, hey, good deeds aren't bad in and of themselves. Good doctrine isn't bad in and of itself. Great history, a legacy, a good pedigree of leadership, these are all good things. And I want you to keep doing good deeds because you love me. He's saying that we need to love Jesus first, and then all these things will flow out. Then we'll be wanting to serve him. Then all these things will happen in the right order. Well, he says one last thing at the end that brings a lot of hope too. He has a promise. So verse 7, let's check that out. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. This is a cool phrase, he who has an ear, let him hear. Jesus actually uses this in his earthly ministry at the beginning of the New Testament, in the Gospels. In each Gospel, he says to his disciples and the crowds many times, he who has an ear, let him hear. And he's referring perhaps to reminiscing of Isaiah 6, where Isaiah says the same thing. This is a prophetic call. This has an idea of prophecy. Again, Revelation is prophetic, apocalyptic literature. Jesus is saying, listen up, there's truths about the kingdom of heaven, and I want you to hear them. Open up your eyes, open up your ears, open up your heart to what I'm saying. And it's cool also to see that the Spirit is involved here too. We see the Spirit described in Acts 2 at Pentecost as a flame that comes and descends upon each of the apostles when he arrives. And it's interesting to think that as a lampstand, the lamp, the church, is at the base, but there always need to be that source of light, right? That flame, that beacon to the nation, that warmth, that life in the church. That's the Holy Spirit. And he's here in this letter too, also communicating with the Ephesians. Now, to him who overcomes, the person who overcomes is the Christian who hangs in there to the bitter end, who stays faithful to Christ to the very end. Oh, and this would have been such a close thing for the Ephesians to understand, because they're in the midst of persecution and it's about to get really rough. We'll see this in the later letters that talk more about persecution as well. But right here it says, to him who overcomes. Now, Jesus Christ is going to come back at the end of all things in Revelation 19 and 20 and defeat evil for all time. He is the one with the power. He is the one with the authority to do that thing. But the Christian, who is a conqueror, as this word is also translated, they are a conqueror in how they stay steadfast and keep loving Jesus throughout, all the way to the end. Jesus says, love me first. And he also promises two cool things. Now, he promises two things. To eat of the tree of life in the paradise of God. And I want to talk about the first one, the second one first, the paradise of God. Now, this would have a lot of reference to Old Testament images, right? The tree of life was in the paradise of God. We can look back to the Garden of Eden, a sense of innocence, a sense of beauty, a sense of holiness and set apart, a sense of perfection in the Garden of Eden. But then Jesus uses this exact phrase, paradise, if you remember on the cross, where the thief next to him realizes, whoa, this guy is not who he once thought he was, and I do not even belong to be next to him on the cross. He says, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus says in Luke 23, I tell you the truth, you will be with me in paradise today. So Jesus uses the paradise term to refer to heaven and to this coming age as well. Now, paradise would have meant something even more powerful for the Ephesian Christian. If I stood up here and said, you know, friends of mine in Long Beach, it's interesting how downtown has a lot of pride in the demonstrations they hold. I think you kind of might get what I'm alluding to by saying that. But you'd have to be in this culture, you'd have to be in this time to kind of get what I'm referring to. When John says, and you're going to have the paradise of God, that's going to draw some really strong cultural images for them. Let me explain. So we're going to look back at the Ephesians' mindset. When they hear paradise, they would think of that lush, walled, safe, garden full of great things surrounding the Artemis temple. That's what it was called, a paradise garden. They would think of that, except no longer with this pagan substitute satisfy. They would get the real garden. They would get a renewed Eden. They would get everlasting sanctuary from all sin, from all evil, perfect safety. And not only would it just be a place where some deity dwells, God himself, the true God, would dwell in this paradise. The true God would be there, and all of that is offered to the Ephesian Christian who overcomes. And in that garden, we see the tree of life. Old Testament background again is clear. In Eden, in the third chapter of Genesis, we see again this tree of life in the Garden of Eden. The tree of life was a symbol of life in Proverbs 11:30, and also of future abundance in Ezekiel 47:12. And if you have a chance to ever read the first 12 verses of Ezekiel 47, that's a powerful image. He's describing the new heaven that's going to come and the new age that's to come. And the tree of life is there. It's providing life and abundance to all who can partake of it. And so John refers to this, and Jesus writes this through John in this letter, and all the Christians are going to be like, oh, the tree of life. Wow. And not only that, but again, they would think back to the date palm tree that was behind all these images of Artemis. Once again, they'd have only to pull out a Roman coin or a Greek coin and see that tree of life that was supposed to bring fertility, that was supposed to bring abundance and life. But no longer would that pagan substitute satisfy. Jesus, through John, is saying, you guys, if you overcome and if you love Jesus first, you're going to get the real tree of life. You're going to be growing that in the real paradise. It'll have power to feed all the nations and to heal the nations as well. It's created by the King of Kings and the true God, not Artemis, and it's offered to the Ephesian Christian who overcomes. Man, both of these images, the paradise and the tree of life, are culminated at the end of all things. And if you read Revelation 22, verse 1 and 2, you'll see them both there. Jesus is referring to the end of times, and he's revealing that to the Ephesian Christians. And the fundamental characteristic of the one who overcomes, it's someone who loves Jesus first. Well, I'd like to tell you that the end of the story for the church of Ephesus is a happy one. And it is for that first generation. There's a guy named, what is his name? I think it's Ignatius. Yeah, I just wanted to get that right. Ignatius is an early church father. He's in the next generation after Ephesus, and he writes an epistle to them, a letter to the church of Ephesus, and he says, from Ignatius to the church in Ephesus, who is known for its love. Wow. Whose very name means love to all the churches in Asia. They made it. They did it. They heard Jesus' words in this letter, and they followed through and obeyed them. And their church was changed. Their lampstand wasn't taken away. They were able to be a vibrant, thriving church and spread God's gospel in that area because they obeyed what he said. Now, I'd like to invite the worship team back up because I think it's about that time for them to come. But I'd like to ask you, what about us today? Here at Long Beach Alliance Church, our mission is to love God, love others, and serve the world. But we can't love others and serve the world if we're not loving God first. How many people will sometimes say that they have a relationship with God, but they never spend time with Jesus? They say they're a Christian, but when do they ever take intentional time to share personally with Jesus? They've got deeds. They've got great doctrine. They've got a great family history or a great perseverance in what they've done. But you can't love someone that you never spend time with. Now, it's going to take a lot of courage for some of us to take those steps to love Jesus again. But Jesus has a habit of always having open arms, doesn't he? And he always does accept us back. He is gracious, and he is calling us to love him first. So don't give up hope. However you serve, and wherever you go, and whomever you serve for the gospel, and whatever good deeds you do, remember to love Jesus first.